Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm with the club's Business and Leadership Forum, and your host for today's program, which is entitled, How Behavioral Science Can Help Us to Have a Good Day. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Caroline Webb, the author of How to Have a Good Day. The author will be signing books at the conclusion of this program.
Thank you. Well, it's a delight to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I must start by admitting that despite the fact that I've written a book called How to Have a Good Day, not every day in my past has been a good one. Obviously, at this point, I should be escorted from the premises. But, you know, when I stand in front of a group like you and I'm about to give a talk, I'm vividly reminded of one day early in my career as a management consultant when I was being allowed to give a presentation to the board of a client for the first time. So this was exciting. I was excited. I was also, in fairness, a little bit nervous. And so I was trying to think about how to project gravitas and presence into the room. And I was mostly doing this by striding about as boldly as I could. And in my mind, I was owning the room. I'd even checked the ground for cables because I was wearing heels and I didn't want to trip over. What happened next, unfortunately, was something I had not prepared for, which was that as I took an especially bold step into the middle of the room, I heard a crack. Now, some of you will know what happened next, but I didn't until it happened. It turns out it's actually entirely possible for a heel on a high-heeled shoe to snap completely off. Yes, there are several of you nodding. Yeah, know this now. So, as I was lying on the floor, it turned out to be quite hard to project any more gravitas or presence into the room. So, not every day can be an amazing day. We all face constraints. We have perhaps wardrobe malfunctions, technology glitches, difficult people to deal with, different difficult deadlines. But I've always been drawn to a philosophy that I think of as realistic optimism, by which I mean being realistic about the constraints that you face, not asserting everything is awesome, but actually acknowledging and understanding the constraints that we face in everyday life so that we can find ways through and around those constraints to make every day slightly but significantly better. And my toolbox for that realistic optimism has always been behavioral science, by which I mean the behavioral bits of neuroscience, psychology, and economics. These are the researchers who are trying to help us understand why we think, feel, and behave the way that we do. And it is an optimistic message because we only have to understand a little bit about how the brain works to have much more sense of where our scope for control is over things that actually seem tend to seem quite random in our lives. And I'm going to give you four examples of things that feel quite fixed in everyday life, that actually a bit of understanding of behavioral science points towards ways that we can make things better. And I'm going to talk first of all about how we can shift the reality that we experience, just starting with the big one, you know, just diving straight in there. I'm going to talk about how we can get more time in the day. I'm going to talk about how you can magically boost your intelligence and creativity on demand. And I'm going to talk about how you can remote control other people's moods. So these are four things that we tend to think we kind of just have to roll with each day. You've got a bit more control than you think. So let's get started. Let's talk about the big one, first of all. Let's talk about how you fundamentally shift the way that you experience reality, the things that happen to you in a given day. I'm going to talk about a day that was actually a bit further on in my career as a management consultant. It was also not a great one. And I was just joining a new project. I wasn't happy about it. It was not the kind of project that I loved, but my boss had said that I would compliment a colleague called Lucas. He was very focused on operational details, and I was supposed to bring the softer side, the people side, to the project. So it's the first day that we're meeting the clients on this project, which is supposed to help the company transform its performance. And I'm grumpy because I don't really want to be on the project. Turn up for the meeting, and even worse, we're not even meeting the clients in person. You know, it's our kickoff meeting where we're trying to get to know each other, and it's a video conference. So it's in this dark room with a low ceiling, long and thin. We sit down, and we've got faces on a screen in front of us. I'm just sure it's going to be a terrible meeting. This is not the way that you should start a project. And I was right. You know, Lucas is sitting there. He's got a deck of paper this thick, and he's plowing through. He's high energy. He's just pushing forward, presenting his pages. Meanwhile, I'm noticing lots of people with frowns on their faces, people interrupting each other. It's just as bad as I expected. And at the end, I have a bit of a cloud over my head, and I feel that I wasn't able to bring the people side to the meeting at all. I felt like I needed to talk to Lucas about this bad start that we'd had to the project, getting off on the wrong foot with the clients. So I sat down with him, and I can still picture him in my office, sitting about where you are. And I told him about my concerns, that we got off to not a great start. And he was looking at me totally incredulously. He had no recollection of what I was talking about. But more interesting than that, not only did he not recognize or remember the frowns that I was talking about, he did a very good job of laying out all the times that the clients had said that they were really happy, all the times that people had said, this is a great meeting, that we're making great progress, the times that people had laughed. And it was just on the edge of my consciousness that I realized that he wasn't making this up. But it got me thinking. It made me wonder, how was it possible that we would experience a couple of hours so very differently? And of course, of particular interest to me, why was it that he enjoyed himself so much more than I did? And some of it was about personality, of course. But it really was as if we'd seen and heard different things. And this is where understanding a little of how the brain works really helps us. Because it turns out that what was going on was something that's happening to all of us all the time, which is this. Your conscious brain is marvelous, especially the ones that are in the room, obviously. But it has capacity constraints. It can only take in a certain amount of what's around us at any given time. When you think about so many of the little details that are around you that you're not paying attention to right now, you could focus on this lovely mark that's on the floor. You could focus on the hairs on the head of the person sitting in front of you or next to you. You could really, really get quite obsessed with every single hair, actually, if you really wanted to. If your brain paid attention to everything around you consciously, it would crash like an overloaded computer with all of its keys pressed at once. So we have a super elegant solution, which is that our brain actually filters out most of the information that's around us at any given time, subconsciously. So we're not aware of it, which is how it's supposed to work, because if we were aware of it, then it wouldn't be saving us any mental effort. But the reality then is that what we perceive as reality is actually just an edited, incomplete version of real, complete, objective reality. Now just think about that for a moment. It means that each of us perceives only part of what's going on. And then the interesting question, of course, is, well, what's the pattern? You know, what do we tend to notice consciously, and what does our brain tend to filter out? And there is a pattern, and this is where our opportunity lies, because what we tend to notice consciously, what our brain makes sure that it filters in rather than filters out, is anything that resonates with what's already top of mind for us. So let me give you an example. There's a study that was done at Harvard using a bunch of radiologists. And they're the people that look at scans of your body to see if there's anything wrong. Breaks, tumors, nodules, that sort of thing. They had a stack of lung scans to go through. And in the last of the lung scans in this pile, there was a gorilla printed inside one of the lungs. How many of the radiologists saw the gorilla? Almost none. 83% of them didn't see the gorilla. Even more interesting, eye tracking devices showed that most of them looked directly at it. And the gorilla wasn't tiny, it was 48 times the size of the average lung nodule, which was what they were looking for. And these are people who are trained to spot abnormalities. So why didn't they see the gorilla? Because it wasn't top of mind for them. They weren't expecting to see it. It wasn't their aim. They didn't have an attitude that said, I'm going into this looking for gorillas. They didn't assume that they were going to find a gorilla. They didn't see the gorilla as a result. That's how powerful the brain's filtering mechanism is. It's remarkable. It's called selective attention. It's a mechanism that we use to navigate everyday life, the complexity of everyday life. The big opportunity for us then is that it really makes a difference what our starting point is. In other studies, researchers found that people who were in a bad mood saw a steep hill as steeper and less pleasurable to climb. People in a bad mood rated other people as less likable. Our starting point colours our perceptions dramatically. So that's why if you've ever bought a new car, you suddenly see all the cars on the road that are your model. Last week I bought some Nike sneakers for the first time in my life. And I have to say that I had not noticed that half of New York wore Nike sneakers. And I suspect that they did not all buy them in the previous 10 minutes. They were there before. So this was all there before. The cars were there before. The hill is as steep as it is. The sneakers were there before. The question is, what filters are you bringing into the situation? Now, when you think about how this plays out in everyday life, it means that if you go into a conversation expecting that someone's going to be a jerk, you will see everything that confirms that you're right to think that this person is a jerk. You might miss a smile or a more conciliatory comment that they make. You're perfectly able to actually filter out signs that are more collaborative. If you go in with collaboration top of mind, you're going to have a different experience. So of course Lucas had a different experience to me. He showed up differently. He had a different set of aims, different set of assumptions about what was going to happen. I assumed it was going to be terrible. Unsurprisingly, it kind of was. So now, what do I do differently? I do something which I call setting intentions, which is just my little code for taking a moment before I go into doing anything that matters to me to say, okay, what's my real aim here? I'm going to use a little bit of alliteration. It helps me remember. What's my real aim here? What attitude do I want to have? And what assumptions do I want to have going into this? And it takes 10 seconds before stepping into a conversation that matters. It takes 30 seconds to sit at the beginning of the day and look across the day and say, what really matters today? And I have to say that I actually have never had a bad meeting like the one that I had with Lucas that day, ever since I started using this intention setting technique. Because even when you're in the middle of something which is going wrong, you can still catch yourself and do a tiny time out and say, okay, now what really matters here? And if my aim at that moment is, okay, well, this is clearly awful, but I want to see what I can learn from this, I'll at least experience the rest of the meeting differently to how I would have had I not consciously reset my filters at that point. Super nice thing to do as well if you're having a little bit of a stressful moment. Maybe it's at work, maybe it's on a commute, and you're stuck, and you notice that you're in a bad mood. If you take a moment to say, in the next 5 minutes, I am going to notice three delightful things, come what may, through gritted teeth even, you notice three good things. Maybe it's someone being delightfully helpful in holding open a door, or maybe it's just a delightful hat that someone is wearing. You just put different things top of mind, you're more likely to see more good things after that, because your brain will be saying, okay, I'm going to match whatever's already top of mind for her. So this is quite a powerful way of shifting the way that you experience each day. It's not just untethered positive thinking. It's really saying consciously to yourself and deliberately to yourself, how do I become more intentional about the filters that I'm presenting to the day, knowing that your experience of reality is really subjective. You might as well make it more of what you want to see and hear. So that's the first point. That's the first point about reality. Now I'd like to talk about how we get more time in the day. Who would like more time in the day? Yes, absolutely. So I'm a bit of a science fiction geek. So I know that one way to get more time in the day is apparently to go to the edge of a black hole. But that's kind of tough to fit in Monday lunchtime. So I'm going to talk about another way that science tells us that we can feel as if we're stealing back some time in the day. And I'm going to get you to do a very short exercise to illustrate it. And it doesn't require standing up. You'll be delighted to know. I'm going to ask you to count to seven out loud, on my mark, as fast as you can. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like that. Do you understand what I'm asking you? Great, fantastic. Okay. Are you ready? Go. Exactly, like that. Now I'd like you to do the same with letters. So you say A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Are you ready? Okay. Go. Even better. Wonderful. Not at all cult-like in any way. Now, I would like to ask you to do something which should take about the same amount of time put together. I'd like you to mix the two up. I'd like you to say A1, B2, C3. Yeah? Yeah. You know what I'm asking. Okay. Are you ready? Go.
A1, B2, C3, D4,
E5, 6, G7. I don't know how much the microphones are picking this up, but there's one of you who finished. So what happened? Let me ask some obvious and slightly leading questions. You just demonstrated 20 years of research into multitasking. And you're going to really demonstrate it even more by answering these two simple questions. One, which was easier? When did you make faster progress? When you were doing them separately or mixed up?
Separately.
Right, separately. When did you make more mistakes? When you did it separately or mixed up?
Mixed up.
Right, okay. Just to be clear, just want to check that that is genuinely your experience. After all, we all know about the subjectivity of reality now, right? So what does this tell us? It tells us what the research has shown us, which is that when we multitask, we slow ourselves right down. We feel busy, but we slow ourselves right down, and we make between 2 and 4 times as many errors as when we do one thing at a time. Now, why is that? Why is that? The reason is that our conscious brain, as well as having capacity constraints, can also only do one thing at a time. We have a kind of impression that we can do more than one thing at a time, right? But actually, when we're checking email, while we're looking at a website, while we're trying to have a conversation, trying to write that thing we're supposed to write, what we're actually doing is asking our conscious brain to switch from one task to another. We don't always realize it because the switches are small and kind of invisible to us. But what we're actually asking our brain to do is a little bit what we were asking our brain to do just then in switching between letters and numbers. And in each of those switches, going from letters to numbers and back again, you're losing a microscopic amount of time and mental energy. Add that up, and that's why when we multitask, we slow ourselves down and we make many more errors, and we make poorer decisions as well. So the science is clear. We actually get our work done more quickly, get anything done more quickly if we do one thing at a time, if we do what I call single tasking. So of course the challenge then is, yes, but we're in an always-on environment these days. We have emails arriving and messages arriving at any time. We actually quite like this feeling of being connected to the rest of the human race. It brings us so many benefits. And yet, it comes at a hell of a cost when you think about what the impact is of staying online all the time while you're trying to do everything else. So I've been thinking about this for quite a long time. What is practically the right way to try and get more single tasking into your day so that you can essentially create some extra time in your day? And I've been experimenting with lots of different ways of doing this. So I certainly am quite aggressive about putting my phone on airplane mode. I'm quite aggressive at batching my email processing so that I really blitz it in the morning and the evening. And therefore, I'm not switching all the time from email to task to email to task. I do a bit less of that because I blitz my email twice a day rather than twice a minute. I have to say, though, that when I left my job to write my book, I actually had to raise my game on the single tasking front because I had so much less structure in my day. I would sit in front of the computer, I'd be there on my own, I'd have no colleagues around me, I'd have no short-term deadlines, just this enormous deadline of writing the book. And so I found that even though I would perhaps put my phone on airplane mode so emails weren't coming in, I would find all sorts of ways around it. I would go online and then I'd start browsing. And so I decided that I had to step up. I discovered that there were apps that allow you to block certain websites. I actually used one of those to make sure that I wasn't on social media between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m., more than 10 minutes. And that really helped a great deal. But I tell you what was actually transformational for me was having a timer on my desk where I chose the number of minutes that I was going to actually stay focused. And then I would let it count down to zero. And you know why I liked it so much? It was because when it got to zero, it would beep. And it would make me feel great. I needed that little sense of reward for being able to concentrate, because I was needing to replace a little bit of the thrill of an email coming in or a call coming in and making me feel wanted. And that little trick of having a number to focus on and then feeling good about running it down to zero really helped me. And I will admit that I had to start at 5 minutes. Yeah. So what I'd like to ask you to think about is when you think about your most important task this afternoon, tomorrow, how can you do it while single tasking? What would it take to put a little bit more protection around your brain to allow it to do the kind of thinking that it really is able to do when it's at its best? What would it take for you to go offline or create the space? Maybe it's putting on a big pair of headphones so that you can signal to everybody that you're trying to concentrate. Maybe it's getting a timer. The more you can single task, the more time you'll effectively end up having in your day. So that's the second thing. The third thing that I want to talk to you about is how do you boost your intelligence on demand? So this is a very intelligent group. But even you know that there are days when you're firing on all cylinders and days when you're not, right? There are days when you come up with the witty comment at the moment that you need to say the witty comment, and days when it comes to you 2 hours later in the restroom and you think, yes, that's what I should have said. That's what I should have said. Bam. There are days when you're engaged in a task. It might be thinking about how to juggle your family commitments. It might be thinking about how to handle a big business issue. It doesn't matter what it is, but there are days when you can see a path forward and days when you can't. And I'm going to talk about a way that we can boost our creative problem solving on demand. And it comes back to something that happened a bit later on in my career still. I had decided that I really wanted to develop some coaching skills. So I was doing work in my management consulting life that involved transforming companies and organizations, but I was really most excited about the work that was quite intimate. I would work with individuals and teams and help them shift the way that they were behaving and think about how to lead a change more broadly across their colleagues. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to get deeper into this sort of personal coaching side of things. So I did this course. I got qualified as a coach. And it was a sort of sweet disaster, really. Because the sweet bit was, I loved it. I loved it so much. I loved it so much that the disastrous bit was that I was very clearly going to have to quit my job as a management consultant and become an executive coach. And I actually didn't much want to quit my job for all sorts of reasons that you might guess. First of all, I quite liked my job. I quite liked my colleagues. I quite liked the security. I quite liked the sense of belonging. I've been there quite a long time. So I was really struggling with this. Definitely a first world problem. Oh, I did a course and it's so wonderful. I have to quit my job. I mean, I accept. But it was one of those sort of career dilemmas that maybe come up two or three times in your life. And it was hard and I couldn't see a way forward. I knew I was going to have to quit. And so when you're doing this sort of coaching training, when you're training to be a coach, or indeed, I'm sure the same is true of many training courses, you have to practice, right, in order to really learn. And so the way that we used to practice was we used to get into pairs and coach each other on real issues that were going on in our lives. This was a way of practicing techniques. We'd often be watched and filmed while we were doing it so that we could hone our skills as coaches. So on this particular day, I was working with a woman called Jill, and she was needing to practice on me. And she said, okay, Caroline, pick a topic to be coached on. And I said, okay, well, the real topic that's on my mind is quite big. Do you mind? She said, no, bring it on. So I said, okay, I would like you to sort out my career for me. I said, no, I'm going to have to quit. This is going to be terrible. How do I handle it? So she got me to talk about the issue. I was getting myself quite wound up. And then Jill said, no, stop for a moment, Caroline. Tell me what the ideal situation looks like. And I'll be honest, I was actually a bit dismissive because I said, if the ideal were possible, I wouldn't be sitting here. Puh. But she pushed me and she said, no, just inhabit that a little bit. Talk about what the ideal really would look like. And the ideal, of course, is that I will be a coach, but still working for my glorious management consulting company, which didn't really work because they don't do coaching. But she persisted and she said, no, stick with the ideal. So the ideal is, and I started talking about what the ideal would look like, what the days would look like and feel like. I started to have quite a good time talking about it. And then she said, okay, so what's the very first step toward that? And of course, at that moment, it was blindingly obvious to me that I should simply tell all of my colleagues that this is what I wanted to do, that I wanted to do more executive coaching. Because if I was going to leave anyway, I had nothing to lose. And you're all looking at me as if this is very, very obvious, Caroline. But why was it that I couldn't see that that was a smart first step when I was focused on the problem? And the answer goes back to another thing that we know about our brains. And it's the fact that we are very well set up to spot threats in our environment. This has kept us safe for millennia. Our brains are constantly scanning multiple times a second to see if there's anything that seems at all threatening around us. And this is not just about a saber-toothed tiger running towards you. Our brains are very attuned to other types of threats that are a little bit more existential and a little bit more common in the workplace. So things like challenges to your social standing, challenges to your self-respect. One thing that can challenge your self-respect is your feeling that you're stuck and you can't solve a problem. Yeah, anything that undermines your feeling of competence and autonomy can be interpreted by our brains as a threat. So there are a few things to know about then what happens. The first thing to know is that this is quite a hair trigger thing. This reaction, this defensive reaction that the brain mounts when it perceives a threat is a very fast and very instinctive reaction that can be provoked by anything quite mild, such as feeling stuck on a problem. The next thing to know is that when your brain goes into defensive mode, it launches a fight, flight, or freeze response. And when it's launching that fight, flight, or freeze response, which in the workplace or in the family situation does not, of course, look like punching someone, not generally, fight, flight, or freeze in our everyday lives more often looks like a snappish comment. That's a fight response. Or flight might be just kind of ignoring and running away. Freeze might be just, maybe that is, you know, why someone hasn't replied to an email. Fight, flight, and freeze is our natural response to threats that come our way. Our brain is keeping us safe. But when we're under stress, negative stress in that way, researchers have found that there is less activity in our brain's prefrontal cortex. Now, what that means, some of you may know what that means. This is where our more sophisticated neural functions tend to sit. The functions that are responsible for reasoning, self-control, planning, grown-up stuff. So just to recap, what happens when you're feeling threatened by a problem you can't solve is that you go slightly on the defensive and your brain decides to divert mental energy away from clever thought to defensive mechanisms like fight, flight, or freeze, like snapping at Jill, well, why would you say that? That's no use. In other words, you become dumber just when you want to be smart. It's a shame, isn't it, really? But what did Jill do that was so, so very helpful and that we can use every single day? What she did was she used something called positive framing. She forced me to get out of thinking purely about the problem and how to fix it. And she got me to think about what's the ideal situation and what would be the first step towards it. And what she's effectively doing there is shifting my brain's focus from the threat to potential rewards in the situation and feeling competent and feeling that there's a way forward, that you've been able to create a way forward, is a very sweet reward for the brain. And as a result, she'd taken me out of defensive mode and allowed me to re-engage more of my higher reasoning skills, let's say. So this is something that we can use any time we get stuck, or indeed any time you see people around you getting a bit cranky and a little bit fixed in their views, is to ask a positive question that doesn't gloss over the problem. It doesn't mean you don't solve the problem. It doesn't say, let's not talk about the problem. It says, let's frame the problem in a way that allows your brain to do its best possible thinking about the problem. So Jill's question is one I use every day. What's the ideal situation and what's the first step towards that? Another one I really like is, when have I solved a problem like this in the past? And what does that tell me about what I can do today? So play around with some of these questions next time you get stuck, and you'll notice a boost to your creativity and intelligence that's quite instantaneous. And it's something that you can give as a gift to other people around you too. Talking of other people, other people's moods. Wouldn't it be great if we could just switch someone's mood on and off, just like that? Perhaps you're all thinking of one particular person whose mood you would like to change. There was another day later, still, in my career, when I was magically a coach at my management consulting firm. Because following the conversation with Jill, I had gone around telling everybody, I want to do more coaching. And magically, of course, because I had told people that I wanted to do more coaching, not only did I, because this was top of mind, spot more opportunities, but other people were able to bring me opportunities to coach their clients. So this was a pretty fantastic setup. I was loving my life. I was working in Paris, also very nice. I was working with four lawyers, and they were in a little coaching group that I had formed, and it was a wonderful setup because I was there to coach them as a group, but they were also coaching each other. And as you know, it's wonderfully helpful to have a chance to coach someone else on a problem you're facing because it allows you to see answers that you might not otherwise have seen. So we had this wonderful conversation. They were helping each other, being mutually supportive. I was injecting the occasional structuring device to help the conversation move forward. It was great. There were actually only three of them in the room, not four, because the fourth person was late. And I was fine with that because I knew ahead of time that she was going to be late. But what happened after we'd been having this fantastically productive, supportive, even humorous conversation of an hour, was that she burst through the door. I'm going to make some noise now. Burst through the door. Threw herself down in a chair in a way that I've not seen anyone do before or since. Like, sorry for those who are sitting behind. The stress was rippling off her. It was remarkable. She was clearly not having a good day. But what happened next was even more interesting than the way that she'd entered the room. Because what she was doing in this rippling of her stress across the room was sending signals to everybody else who was in the room. And honestly, it was as if a virus was spreading. She said, "When is the next of these sessions? Oh, that's so annoying. I can't make it. How annoying." The other three guys, who had been previously totally happy and who had actually already said that they were able to make the next session, then all pulled their phones out and said, "Huh, it's not in my calendar. That's really annoying. Annoying, annoying, annoying." I watched as this was happening, and I knew what was going on because I knew the research on emotional contagion. See, what's interesting is that because we're such a social species, we are very deeply wired to pick up the emotions of other people. There is a lot of disagreement, I should say, in behavioral science circles on exactly what the mechanism is behind that. But there's no doubt about the fact that it happens. So if someone comes into a room, one study has shown that people's emotions sync up within 5 minutes. Even if that person comes in a bad mood, doesn't speak to anyone else, and you're not even working on the same task. Now, this is what was happening. She was radiating this emotion into the room. But since I'm talking to you about what can you do to control situations that seem uncontrollable, where's your space for action, your wiggle room? Obviously, I was thinking this to myself at that moment. I was thinking, what can I do? Because I was obviously feeling at that point quite irritated. I mean, certainly there was a bit of irritation. There was certainly, perhaps more dominantly in my mind, worry. I mean, this session was about to go very badly south. And I wasn't really sure, you know, what was going to happen next. It was all starting to get a bit spiky. So if I was going to just let my emotions sit there, I knew that I was going to put that into the room and make things worse. Maybe just at the margin, but it was going to amplify the tension rather than decrease it. So I thought, okay, knowing the research on emotional contagion, what do I want to put into the room? Might not totally transform the moment, but it might make a bit of a difference. So I have to say, in my defense, that I was in Paris. It was Valentine's Day. And so when I thought about what emotion I wanted to put into the room, the first thing that came to mind was love. Now, I would not have said that out loud to these hard-nosed lawyers. But I thought, okay, no, I want to radiate something positive immediately into the room. Love is what it is. I thought about everything I loved about working with them. I really, really thought about everything that had been fantastic about our interactions, including my interactions with this woman. I threw in a mental image of my husband for good measure, you know, anything that was going to put me in a different state of mind. And I felt a settling. I had a big grin on my face. I was just radiating this more positive state of mind into the room, and I felt a settling. Thank goodness. It really did feel like we'd come back from the brink. So there's an interesting question about what you're bringing into any conversation, especially one that might be a bit high stakes or a bit tense. Especially, you know, if you're in a conversation, you suddenly notice the other person's getting uptight. What can you do to radiate what you want into the space? So what I was effectively doing in that moment where I was sitting thinking, what do I do? I was revisiting my intentions. I was thinking, well, what's my real aim for the session? I was saying, okay, well, actually, I kind of slightly want to punch her, but that's my fight, flight, freeze response. So let's actually refocus on the fact that I really want them to have a great learning experience. So how about I think about what my attitude is that I put into the room? That was where the love bit came in. But I tell you what also helped was also a technique that I call good person, bad circumstances. Bit of a mouthful. But the way it works is this. We have a tendency, when we see bad behavior in other people, to treat it differently to how we treat ourselves. So if I turn up and I'm cranky and perhaps a bit slow, I know that I haven't slept well last night, and that's the reason why. But if someone else turns up and they're cranky and slow, I assume they're an unpleasant person and they're a bit dim. We have a tendency to ascribe bad behavior in ourselves to circumstances, bad circumstances. In other people, we tend to ascribe it to bad character. It's simpler. It actually saves our limited capacity brain from thinking too hard. We just badge people, we label people. We say, oh, right, they obviously that's how they are. But when you experience a bad situation where someone's behaving in a way that's upsetting or challenging, it's actually a nice way of reducing your own tension to think they may not actually be a psychopath. In fact, statistically likely that they're not a psychopath. So I ask myself, what are the circumstances that could be creating this behavior in her? You know, what has put her on the defensive, basically? What has put her brain on the defensive? What might have created this behavior in her? And the wonderful thing about that is, of course, you can have some fun with the stories that you make up. They don't actually have to be true. You can think about, one of my favorites is, maybe this person's cat vomited on them this morning. Maybe I remind them of a teacher that threw a stapler at their head when they were a child. It's terrible, shouldn't laugh, but kind of just allows you to consider the possibility that what you're observing is someone who is going through something difficult rather than someone who is difficult. And that is what helped me in the moment to shift my attitude and to put a different type of emotional contagion into the room. So good person, bad circumstances. Next time you see someone who's a bit grumpy, what can you do to make up a story to explain what might be causing their fight, flight, or freeze response? Have some fun with it. So just to revisit what we've covered, I've talked about how setting intentions, taking 10 seconds to set your intentions about what you want to see more of, will make sure you see more of it. What's your aim, your attitude, your assumptions as you go into anything in your day? That will change the reality that you experience. You'll get more time in the day if you can manage a single task more and more as you're focusing on the work that matters most to you or the conversations that matter most to you. And you think about any time that you're getting stuck or just need to give yourself an intellectual creative boost using some positive framing by saying, what's the ideal and how do I move towards that? Will unleash a bit of extra IQ. And then lastly, recognize your power for emotional contagion. Think about what it is that you're able to put into the room when you're experiencing an interaction that's less than perfect. And think about what circumstances might be creating the bad behavior you're experiencing. And I think if you can do all of those things, that is a pretty great recipe for a good day. Thank you.
I want to remind the audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we're listening to Caroline Welp, who is with us today on the subject of how behavioral science can help us have a good day. Since I have the microphone, maybe I'll begin. You've been traveling around. You've been talking about your book. How has it changed you?
Oh.
Are there other ways that you now have a good day?
What an interesting question. Thank you. I tell you what I have noticed is that, you know, I'm sort of on my fourth career at this point, although there's always been a kind of common thread of focusing on behavioral change. And I have noticed that each time my context has changed, my work has changed, I've needed to rethink a little bit at how I do all the things I've just been talking about. So I mentioned earlier on that my approach to single tasking had to go up a notch when I was on my own so much more. And I suppose the thing is that, you know, I'm just very conscious of everything that I'm doing being totally new right now and having to be much more deliberate and intentional about all the things which had sort of become second nature to me. So I have to be a little bit more conscious of, I'm going to set my intentions going into this wonderful, lovely talk. I'm going to think about how do I get the protected time this evening to really work on planning the next big piece of work that I need to do. So I think perhaps it puts me more in the same place as everyone else who might be reading the book for the first time, in that, you know, you do have to kind of reinvigorate and reinvent a little bit the way that you think about these ideas. But I like that. I like that. I feel very self-aware at the moment because I'm having to rethink the way I'm organizing my time and my day so frequently. Thank you for the question.
Are there other questions?
Can you talk a little bit about, when you talk about the single-minded focus, you can maybe give an example of writing the book. You mentioned you had cut off social media. Let's say you want to sit down and you started with the 5 minutes. Maybe you say, all right, I'm going to focus on the book for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But obviously that can entail research for the book or, you know, a number of different things, quote unquote, working on the book could entail. Did you do things like you said, okay, well, I don't know, if I'm going to listen to music, it can't be anything too stimulating, can't be talk in the background that I'm going to hear, so it needs to be classical, or I need to only focus on one particular piece of writing the book to make it kind of refine down that single-minded focus?
So kind of yes to all of that, actually. I mean, certainly one thing that, you know, I'm not saying that I was able to go offline, right? I can't. I mean, I was researching right up until the last, I continue to read research papers every day. So there was no point where I could really totally take myself out of the flow of what was going on in the behavioral science world. But what I could do was I could batch similar tasks together more clearly. So I could say, right, this is 2 hours when I'm going to really spend a lot of time reading some papers and scanning to see if there's anything new that's come in that I need to be aware of, and then go offline for a period to focus on the writing. And that's an approach that I really advocate, is to look at your to-do list for the day and group together similar types of tasks so that you're not asking your brain to switch all the time. Do all your calls together. Have a blitz on email. Think about times of day when you're just going to be much better at doing all of your deep thinking tasks. So I think, you know, along with just having a set of techniques about going offline, think about how you can batch and zone, if you like, your day. Batch tasks together and zone your day. And then on the music front, spot on, absolutely. So for me, I found that, I've always found that if I listen to music that is too engaging, I can't concentrate because it's using up some of my conscious attention. So for a long time, I was listening to Haydn string quartets that I knew really backwards, and they were so familiar to me that it had become automatic to kind of to absorb them. And our automatic system in the brain can do more than one thing at once. And then later I switched to instrumental deep house music, which is a rather different genre, but I think actually quite similar in that, you know, it's very dry and rhythmic and doesn't have any words. So yes, absolutely spot on the music front. Thank you. I still have a playlist, by the way, that I use to, you know, say, right now, Caroline, this is work time. So, yeah.
Hello, Caroline. Hello. My brother brought me here because he works in HR and he's bought 150 of your books to give to his staff.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'd love you to sign it afterwards. But he's trying to convert me because I'm an entrepreneur, ex-architect, creative. And I was listening to you and I was thinking, hang on a minute, if everybody manages out the emotions and makes everyone having a good day. I think about my creative careers where some of the best work we've done is where we've hated each other and we've had a big cat fight. And actually, because we're a grown up, we resolve things and we got to positive outcomes in the end.
Yeah.
But it was a painful process to go through.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is there a value in the science that you're bringing here that also recognizes that and helps people bring that into the workplace too, or manage it?
Wonderful. Such great questions. Thank you. So, I mean, first of all, I would definitely not say that I'm suggesting you manage your emotions out of the space that you're in. all emotions that we have are there for a reason. You know, evolutionarily, they've really helped us. I definitely wouldn't say that what I'm advocating is ironing out everything bad in your day. What I would say is that to recognize that you've got more choice than many of us realize in how you experience tense situations. So if you are up against a deadline and, you know, you've got to come up with some creative magic, then there's a lot of techniques that you can use to channel that in a more positive direction that enables your brain to think clearly, which I suspect is probably what you're doing when you're in these moments of extreme creative tension. If you were really on the defensive, it would be hard, genuinely, for you to come up with your best work. But there's probably something about the framing of the way that you're working together, perhaps the social capital that you have with the colleagues that you're working with, which means that even as you disagree, and even as you perhaps even shout at each other, it's not something that goes to such a personal depth that you feel personally attacked, and therefore it's perceived as less of a threat, and you're still able to think clearly. So I think, you know, really, I'm trying to create a little bit of a manifesto, not around untethered positive thinking, but around the fact that you have choice in how you experience even the most difficult of situations so that you can be at your best and even get something out of it.
Can you say anything about body posturing and state of mind and mentality, like with reference to NLP? Because I felt like you kind of touched on that at the beginning with your anecdote about, you know, feeling the gravitas and the way you were walking, and that just made me think about NLP.
So when I was looking across behavioral economics, psychology, and neuroscience, I was trying to create a grand synthesis that was the backbone of the book. And there were three big themes that really came up again and again, and I really pulled out as sort of meta themes. And one of them was the mind-body loop, what I call the mind-body loop. And one example of this is obviously the fact that when we sleep, exercise, breathe deeply, we actually see an immediate impact on our cognitive functioning. So we often think about exercise being something great for perhaps our physical health, but the evidence suggests that very quickly it has an impact on our ability to focus and on our mood. So the link between our body and our brain is very strong, not surprising because our brain is part of our body. But one of the things that's especially interesting in this link between the brain and the rest of our body is that we don't seem to distinguish all that much between cause and effect. What I mean by that is when you think about yourself when you're confident, you're more likely to be standing tall, standing proud, perhaps taking your space. When you think about when you're happy, you're more likely to be smiling. When you think about being relaxed, you're more likely to be breathing deeply. And all of those things seem to go the opposite way around as well. The central nervous system seems to take the signals the other way around. So that if we breathe deeply, it turns out that this, obviously, is something we've been telling ourselves for many years. Take a deep breath. Turns out that it really does drop the state of alert in our brain. When we find a reason to smile, it really does boost our mood. That's why I was wandering around beforehand, shaking people's hands and smiling. I know that it's going to boost my own mood. And to the point about power posing, if you adopt a stronger posture, your brain does assume that there's no threat in the environment and you must be fine. So be confident. And there's a lot of research in this area. Again, some disagreement on the mechanism behind it. It's often the case that different disciplines have different ways of describing the same observed phenomenon. But is it part of the lexicon of behavioral science now, this mind-body loop, these feedback loops? Absolutely, yes. So have some fun with it because, you know, it's a really quick way of boosting your mood and your sense of presence to stand up tall, put a smile on your face, and stride forth.
Well, we certainly want to thank Caroline Webb again for this wonderful talk. We want to thank our audience here at the club, as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.